This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Ali Bongo, he might even probably deep in his heart want to resign or want to, due to health reasons, step down. But there is a clique around him who will not allow him to step down because they are benefiting too much.
That was Dr. Edgar Gitua, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert, talking about why he expects Gabon's President Ali Bongo to remain in office after tomorrow's election. Details coming up. Also, the Zimbabwe election monitors have concerns about voting there this week. And we hear from young African leaders. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Gabon holds presidential, legislative and local elections tomorrow. The vote is a much-anticipated test of support for President Ali Bongo. His main challenger is Albert Ondo Ossa. The 69-year-old economics and management professor was picked by an alliance of six main opposition parties as their joint candidate last Friday. I spoke with Dr. Edgar Gitua, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University of Nairobi, about Ossa's chances of winning against the strong Bongo family dynasty, which has ruled the country for almost 60 years.
So the current president, Ali Bongo, inherited this seat from his father, who had been in power for over 44 years. And his father ruled for long because he had French support, he had elite support, the military support. So they entrenched themselves in that country. And unfortunately, like I was saying, it's a small country, around between 2.3 to 2.5 million people. And they pretty much not had faced any serious opposition. So this election going forward is one of those elections where you expect the incumbent to still retain. Remember, he's going for a third term against the hue and cry of most people in his country. But I still believe he will carry the day and not through fair means. So it is one of those tragedies of African politics where we have leaders who want to cling on to power and they do not want to let go.
His main challenger, Albert Ondo Ossa, the 69-year-old economic and management professor, was picked by an alliance of six main opposition parties as their joint candidate last Friday to kind of actually confront President Ali Bongo.
Yes, he's a former serving minister in the government, And in fact, I think as of today, the number probably is bigger of the opposition parties that are lining up behind him. And he's saying he's standing for justice, he's bringing in change. But I can assure you, being an insider or being someone who has been in the system before, he may not be very successful because the grip on power that Ali Bongo and his family and the elite around him have over Gabon's politics is too strong. I have a feeling that the elections, people may come out to vote, but in previous elections, in like, for example, I think 2016, the Gabonese soldiers shot at the voters. So I tend to feel I am slightly skeptical about the freedom or the fairness of the elections that this come this cycle once again. They might have a bit of that violence and disruptions on election day. So this candidate, yes, he presents a credible and strong threat. But I have a feeling the system will work against him. They will just somehow derail the whole process and he will not be declared the winner.
But doctor, detractors say Bongo, he has done too little to funnel Gabon's oil wealth to 2.3 million people living in poverty, and questions his fitness to govern after a stroke in 2018.
Yeah, it's true. He suffered a stroke and he's gradually recovering. In fact, when you watch him, he still walks with a cane and everything, but he's still exhibiting confidence. And unfortunately, what happens with such leaders, and especially when he's this vulnerable, there is what we call groupthink. There is a clique around the president now who take advantage of his weaknesses to perpetuate his continued stay in power so that they can benefit. So what is going to happen right now is that Ali Bongo, he might even probably deep in his heart want to resign or want to, due to health reasons, step down. But there is a clique around him who will not allow him to step down because they are benefiting too much. The siphoning of the oil wealth. Remember, a third of the Gabonese population live below the poverty line. And there is a clique that has benefited for long. Countries like France will not want Bongo to leave power because it is through him that they are able to perpetuate their continued control over the Gabonese oil and all that. So he's, quote unquote, he's a hostage of people around him, a hostage of France, and also probably fearing that after all these many years in power, we're talking about 44 years for the father and 14 years for him. We're talking about close to 60 years in power. If he cedes power, what guarantees does he have that the incoming president will not prosecute him, go for his family wealth, and all those kinds of issues? Those are the things that are probably playing around his mind. So the easier thing for him will be to stay in power, to protect his wealth and to perpetuate his family's dominance in the country.
That was Dr. Edgar Gitua, an international relations, security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University of Nairobi. He spoke with me earlier today from Nairobi. Today, preliminary results in Zimbabwe's election show the ruling party and the main opposition neck and neck in the fight for parliamentary seats. Even so, 80-year-old President Emmerson Mnangagwa's ZANU-PF party is widely expected to maintain its 43-year grip on power. Presidential results have yet to be announced. The Election Commission has 5 days to announce results following the polls. Voting was extended into Thursday in many districts because of issues with ballot papers and long lines. The Carter Center's director of the Democracy Project, David Carroll, who is in Harare monitoring the election process, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that overall the process has gone smoothly, but there were some problems.
It's a complicated context here, but in general, we had observers around the country, and although election day went smoothly in most places, there were a number of areas where getting the ballot papers arrived very late, and so a number of polling stations in Harare, Bulawayo, and Manicaland province needed to be delayed in some cases for quite a long period of time and even into the following day, August 24th. And so I'm sure that you know, can have some consequences and impact on the overall process. And there's also the broader context was one where, it's been a pretty restrictive political environment that also, limited the ability of parties to engage.
And what about that incident that the Carter Center had mentioned in its preliminary statement about the elections with security forces and a monitoring group?
Yeah, so two organizations that work together, ZESN and ERC, they're longstanding, well-known citizen observation groups that have conducted election observation very similar to what the Carter Center does. They do it in Zimbabwe as domestic observers. We're very familiar with them and their work, and they're highly respected, and we're very familiar with their methods and their approach. And they have been observing elections in Zimbabwe for a number of election cycles right now. So it was a surprise, and I think a very unfortunate development when almost 40 of their personnel were detained and put under arrest, and a lot of their equipment was confiscated. This was on the night of the election when it was a critical moment for them to be doing their observation work.
So aside from that incident, were there incidents of violence in this election?
Not on election day and, the days afterwards so far that I'm aware of. There was a couple of incidents in the pre-election period of some killings, not many, isolated. So compared to previous election cycles, it's been relatively peaceful so far, and we're hopeful that it will remain to be in the days ahead.
Are you hopeful that once the election results are announced, that it will be transparent and it will be truthful?
I think what's, on top of everything I've said about the challenges they face so far and the difficult environment, a number of problems with the way the Election Commission wasn't always transparent and in some ways seemed to lack independence in the way they conducted the elections, I think in spite of all of those things, if they can have transparency around the final election results and allow parties and observers access to the polling station level results so that they can verify the accuracy, and if there's problems that they can bring some evidence to bear and challenge through regular established court channels, then there's good reasons to think that things could go well enough so that there's not any kind of outbreak of violence.
That's Carter Center's director of the Democracy Project, David Carroll. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Harare. Voice of America hosted Thursday 18 young African participating in the Mandela Washington Fellowship for Young African Leaders. The program, also known as YALI, brings accomplished leaders from Africa with record of promoting innovation and positive impact on their communities. VOA's John Tanza spoke with several of them. Asafiko Mpako is from South Africa and says her exposure to the United States will help her bring change to her community in South Africa.
I work at the intersection of research and policy, and I'm interested in international policy making and in decisions that are made in this country about Africa and how we can elevate the voices of Africans on the international stage. And so I came here with the intention to build bridges.
She says the narrative about the continent is changing.
I was struck by the level of conversation that is going on now about the continent and how America is repositioning itself and seeing Africa differently. I mean, the idea of Africa being seen as an equal partner came out very strongly in the U.S., the new U.S. strategy towards sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that that is a positive conversation and it should be encouraged.
A Gambian civil society activist who has been in the forefront in the struggle for constitutional amendments in her country was among the fellows visiting VOA. Chernobaye says young leaders in Africa should work together to address the challenges facing the continent.
I've learned a lot. One of the biggest lessons I learned is Africa is not the only continent with problems. That is one. Two, I have learned that nobody's going to come from outside to solve anything for us. This trip has opened my eyes for that. I always knew that to be a fact, but coming here made me realize this to be true. And thirdly, I realized that, like you were just saying in the beginning, that the problems in Africa are not unique to any single country. They are unique. You find them across the board in the entire African continent. So maybe if you want to fix this for me, then the young people need to come together more. There need to be more collaboration than competition and criticism.
Riflo Smitty from Lesotho says her 6 weeks of studies in the United States has taught her one thing important virtue in life.
For me personally, I believe service leadership is about volunteering my skills, not for my own good, but for the betterment of others. Being a leader that understands the people and lives for the people and for the better good of the people, putting them first, understanding their needs and responding to those needs.
Those were just a few of the YALI fellows visiting VOA this week. You listen. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The United Nations humanitarian organization is warning that war and hunger could destroy the whole of Sudan. Intense fighting has decimated the capital Khartoum and Darfur since April 15th, when the fighting broke out between the Sudan Army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. UNICEF's country representative in Sudan, Mandeep O'Brien, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the children bear the brunt of the war.
The ongoing war continues to have a devastating impact on children who are caught in the middle of this crisis and are bearing the heaviest brunt of the hostilities. As we speak, almost 14 million, children in Sudan are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. That is one in every two children in Sudan. The situation is on the brink of catastrophe. We have, as we speak, around 700,000 children who are suffering from severe acute malnutrition.
You're still trying to get food and emergency supplies to, you know, the families and the children that are trapped in Sudan, and you can't get through because of what's happening on the ground. Can you tell me about that?
In spite of these devastating and challenging times, UNICEF, along with our partners, we've stayed and delivered. So some positive pockets of achievements or results for children, for example, we have in 4 months of the conflict reached 4.2 million children and families with urgently needed health supplies. We have reached 2.7 million families with clean drinking water. Another 2.6 million kids under five have been screened for malnutrition. And all of this has been possible because supplies are a lifeline. We've managed against all odds to bring into the country around 6,000 metric tons of life-saving supplies for health, for nutrition, for water and hygiene. And these have been distributed in the non-conflict states, which are receiving the largest numbers of displaced kids and families. In the remaining hotspot conflict states, it's been much more challenging to deliver this critical life-saving assistance. And this is to your point, where access to reaching the most vulnerable children and households has been a massive challenge. We continue to navigate these challenges and do everything possible in partnership to reach these kids.
You mentioned the hotspots, but where are these hotspots you're talking about?
The hotspots are in Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan, and then the Darfur region, as well as the Kordofan.
Are children dying right now because they don't have enough food to eat?
So far, we have received credible reports indicating 435 children have died. And this is due to a combination of factors, certainly hunger, a lack of nutritious diet and food is a big factor. But we have a whole host of other factors. If kids are not getting the life-saving vaccines, if they are not getting clean water, then obviously, unfortunately, mortality is the end.
That is UNICEF country representative Mandeep O'Brien. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Port Sudan. A preliminary U.S. intelligence assessment concluded that an international explosion caused the plane crash that is presumed to have killed Wagner's group leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday eulogized the mercenary leader, even as suspicions grew that he was the architect of the assassination. David DeRoche, a professor of strategy at the National Defense University, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi that given the Wagner's leader insurrection in June, the crash could have been premeditated.
Oh, I would be shocked if it weren't. I mean, the descriptions from people who watched it said that there was clearly an explosion on the aircraft. The Learjet, which was used as a very stable aircraft. As a matter of fact, they're used as air ambulances in North America. So to have something like that, it's hard to imagine it took place if it weren't premeditated. And honestly, I'm a little surprised that it's taken this long for Prigozhin to part the spectral plane.
The Wagner Group became a tool to expand Russian influence in Africa. How could the death of its leader impact Russian strategy in the African continent?
Well, paradoxically, I think we'll actually not see much of a change in Africa. I think part of the reason why Prigozhin was able to survive 10 weeks after he basically captured a Russian city and marched on Moscow was because I think the regime in Moscow wanted to make sure that they understood exactly what Wagner had in place in Africa, how they ran it, and take over that network rather than just cutting it off and letting it wither or die away. So I think, you know, Russia expanded its influence significantly and its military presence in Africa through Wagner. I think that they'll do it, but it'll just be through either more closely controlled mercenary companies or directly through Russian MOD soldiers.
So what comes next? And how might Wagner change?
I think Wagner, the name might remain, but the key leaders, you know, the founder, Dmitry Utkin, died in the crash as well. I think that what you'll have is something that does not operate independently of the Russian Ministry of Defense. It's more like a corporate merger. So there will be an organization probably called Wagner. It will have the same patches and things like that, but it will be entirely controlled by the Russian Ministry of Defense. And these things we've seen in the past where Prigozhin, you know, challenged the Sergei Shoigu, saying, you know, that we could have solved this war, you know, months ago if you gave us the ammunition, stuff like that. We won't see those disputes. This will be a tamed and controlled organization wholly under the control of the Russian Ministry of Defense.
In early 2023, the U.S. labeled Wagner as a significant transnational criminal organization and levied new sanctions against the group. Will the United States escalate its campaign against Wagner Group after its founder was killed?
I don't think that the death of Prigozhin will be connected to any sanctions. I think the sanctions are done for different criteria, like mass murders in Mali, things of that nature. And I think that it's possible, it's probable, more likely than not, that there will be additional sanctions on Wagner as Wagner assets are identified. But I think these will be more closely related to the conduct of Wagner rather than the death of Prigozhin.
David DeRoche, a professor of strategy at the National Defense University, he was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Donald Trump's mug shot was released on Thursday evening after he was booked at an Atlanta jail on more than a dozen felony charges as part of a wide-ranging criminal case stemming from the former U.S. president's attempts to overturn his 2020 election defeat in Georgia. Reuters News correspondent Ryan Chang reports.
Brow furrowed, jaw clenched, Donald Trump appeared in his first ever mugshot Thursday. This came after he was booked on over a dozen felony counts at an Atlanta jail over attempts to overturn his 2020 presidential election defeat in Georgia. He wasted no time trying to turn it to his advantage. The image is now on his campaign website, above a message asking for donations. He also posted the photo on X, formerly known as Twitter. The post appears to be his first on the social media site since his account was banned after the Capitol Hill riots on January 6th. The ex-US president, who is running for re-election in 2024, surrendered to Fulton County Jail on Thursday. He's part of a sprawling 19-person indictment that alleges violation of state racketeering laws, conspiracy, and false statements. Trump supporters arrived outside the jail to show their love for the former president, while other demonstrators urged that he be locked up. Trump agreed to post a $200,000 bond and accepted bail conditions that would bar him from threatening witnesses or his co-defendants. Before boarding his private plane at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport to go back to New Jersey, he repeated his claim that the prosecution for the Georgia case, along with other cases he faces, are politically motivated.
What has taken place here is a travesty of justice. We did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. And everybody knows it. I've never had such support. And that goes with the other ones, too. What they're doing is election interference. They're trying to interfere with an election. There's never been anything like it in our country before.
It's Trump's fourth indictment since leaving office, and he's the first former U.S. president to face criminal charges, even as he mounts another campaign for the White House in next year's elections. It appears that far from damaging his candidacy for the Republican Party nomination, however, the four cases filed against him have only bolstered his standing. He leads the Republican race to challenge Democratic President Joe Biden in the November 2024 election.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.